Hello, and welcome to Ordinary Philosophy Podcast. Here, you can listen to interviews and audio renditions of pieces published at Ordinary Philosophy's website, dedicated to philosophy in the public square and the history of ideas that change the world. For more about Ordinary Philosophy, and to see the photographs and sources and inspiration for each piece, please visit ordinaryphilosophy.com. I'm Amy Cools, creator and editor of Ordinary Philosophy. And it's very good to be with you all once again. As you may know, it's been some months since I've been able to record and publish a new podcast episode and to write anything new as well. I was engaged in researching for and in writing my master's dissertation and then catching up in all manner of things that I had to push aside as well as I was getting that done. It took me a little longer to get back here than I had expected. I love the projects I do for Ordinary Philosophy. I love the research. I love publishing, recording, etc. So I'm very happy to be back. And as I explained before in a previous episode, because I will be pursuing my PhD research also at the University of Edinburgh, Ordinary Philosophy will often have to take a back seat to what that requires. However, I will not be away, but it will be a little more intermittent. But I hope to be able to share ideas and research with you and great new stories I find, great new ideas I come across as often as possible. So anyway, without further ado, here is episode 116, The Bell Tower, Tower of London, Thomas More, Elizabeth I, and Other Histories, part 3. Saturday, May 4th, 2018, continued. After parting with Simon, Lawrence and I step out of the tower grounds for a quick lunch, though when we return, our first stop features sights and stories that could turn anyone's stomach. As you may have guessed, it's the torture room of the Lower Wakefield Tower. As the signage here indicates, the chamber now dedicated to the history and artifacts of the tower's legacy of torture was likely not used for that purpose at the time. However, it's well chosen for its current purpose. The underground stone chamber is entered via a series of short stairways and small narrow doorways, evoking an increasing sense of entrapment among stones as cold and impassive as were the torturer's sympathies. There's no direct link between this chamber and Thomas More or Elizabeth I, but both of them had strong associations with the use of torture. This comes as no surprise when it comes to Elizabeth, since, infamously, torture was used particularly often on political and religious prisoners during her reign. At the time, torture was regarded by many as an effective method of wresting confessions and information from accused enemies of church and state. Though it was illegal under English common law, torture or the threat of torture was nevertheless used in some cases, especially those in which the crime was considered particularly harmful to the state. England had been rife with religious and political turmoil for decades by the time Elizabeth ascended the throne, so there was a driving political interest in restoring order by cracking down on religious and political dissidents. Protestant Elizabeth reversed her elder sister and royal predecessor Mary I's policies designed to restore England to Catholicism, religious ties which their father Henry VIII had severed so that he could divorce his wife and marry Elizabeth's mother Anne Boleyn. So, plots and intrigues against Elizabeth's reign by papal loyalists abounded, and private citizens practiced their Catholic religion in secret since it was once again illegal. Elizabeth believed that national unity necessarily included unity of creed as well as nationwide fealty to her, and under her administration, fines, imprisonment, torture, and even death were seen as effective deterrents to dissent and disloyalty. Many claim that Elizabeth harshly persecuted Catholics and other religious dissenters for practicing their faith at least as ruthlessly as Mary's administration had persecuted Protestants, or at least that Elizabeth had failed to interfere when her officers did so. But other historians characterize Elizabeth's suppression of Catholicism as comparatively mild, except when it was linked to religiously motivated plots to undermine or delegitimize her rule. Elizabeth had many friends who were known Catholics and dissenters, and, especially earlier in her reign, rarely punished them for it so long as they kept their beliefs to themselves. She famously stated that she had, quote, no desire to make windows into men's souls. But those who were perceived threats to the security of Elizabeth's throne were often dealt with ruthlessly, though Elizabeth herself was sometimes reluctant to order such punishment. Initially more hands-off regarding the practice of religion by otherwise loyal private citizens, Elizabeth's administration cracked down more severely on the practice of Catholicism after Pope Pius V excommunicated her in 1570. Prior to this excommunication, Elizabeth seemed to have considered the practice of Catholicism as a private matter of conscience so far as this didn't interfere with their duties as loyal subjects. After the excommunication, however, English Catholics and Elizabeth were all placed in untenable positions. Pope Pius V was not content merely to banish Elizabeth from the church. He called on Catholics to renounce their loyalty and obedience to her on pain of their own excommunication. In doing so, Pius bound politics to religion far more firmly than Elizabeth had done or wanted to do. Since Elizabeth believed in the legitimacy of her own reign and was bound to promote and protect it, she was unable to overlook this attack on her right to rule and felt forced to act. More's connection to torture may be much more troubling since he's a Catholic saint, let alone given that he was in many other ways an admirable character. However, not all see More in such a glowing light. One of the most controversial facts about More is that he advocated torturing recalcitrant heretics. Some might find it more understandable that Elizabeth, as head of state responsible for enforcing the rule of law, would include torture as a tool of enforcement, since it was at least somewhat consistent with the standards of the time. More, likewise, in his tenure as Chancellor of England, was responsible for upholding the rule of law and maintaining national security, and in an era when church and state were so intertwined, this entailed enforcing religious uniformity. Neither More nor Elizabeth had access to the large modern body of evidence that torture is not, in fact, effective in gathering reliable intelligence, nor does it deter ideological extremism. However, as writer Michael Shermer notes, even then, many doubted the rightness and effectiveness of torture, especially those who routinely heard startling and manifestly untrue so-called confessions extricated from those under duress. It seems that the otherwise kindly and intelligent More may have been capable of similar insights if he was not himself blinded by his own zealotry. More's customarily mild and forbearing disposition may have given way to harshness in dealing with heretics because of his deep religiosity in his particular brand of Catholicism. As his biographer Peter Ackroyd writes, quote, More believed in the communion of the faithful, living and dead, while Luther affirmed the unique significance of the individual calling before God. More considered Martin Luther a heretic. According to author and tutor specialist Melita Thomas, More regarded the Catholic Church as a community of souls whose unity with the divine was threatened by heresy much in the same way as a healthy body is threatened by disease. Like a cancerous tumor, heresy must be identified and ruthlessly cut off from the body of the Church. In the case of heretics, there could be no mercy without sincere and complete repentance, since nothing less than the eternal salvation of souls was at stake. Thomas does not offer this as an excuse for More's bloodthirstiness in this regard, but as an explanation. But historian Brian Moynihan is not among those who believe that this explanation excuses More's advocation of torture for heretics. He believes that More was at best inconsistent and at worst hypocritical in this matter. In more than one instance, More confessed to his daughter Margaret Roper his fear of the pain he might suffer if he was tortured or put to death for his refusal to swear to the Act of Succession, which, among other things, rejected papal authority over the church in England. More's refusal had already led to his imprisonment and, he was sure, would ultimately lead to his execution. In a letter written to Margaret on the 3rd of June, 1535, More wrote that his interrogators made the point that More himself, when chancellor, examined heretics and compelled men to answer on pain of death. Why shouldn't More himself, his interrogators asked, suffer the same treatment he had recommended for others? After all, those accused of heresy likewise refused to submit to the authority of the state and the church. More defended himself on the grounds that he could not submit since it was a matter of conscience. But, as his interrogators observed, his defense comes off like a case of special pleading, since that was arguably true of accused heretics as well. Besides, when it comes to those who we honor for their exceptional virtue and expansive moral imagination, commonly used defenses such as, "Well, they were a person of their time," sound less convincing. The point of bestowing the status of sainthood or sage seems to be that those so honored are exceptional, that they should be able to reason and feel beyond the limitations of their own time, especially in matters of morals and justice. For example, I've never accepted the excuse that Thomas Jefferson's slave owning was just an understandable manifestation of his being a man of his time. The plain fact is, Jefferson knew better, but persisted in slave owning and buying and selling, anyway, because freeing them would have caused him personal inconvenience. For both Jefferson and More, insights about the wrongness of their worst practices were available to them, so it's not as if it's a matter of 20/20 hindsight or unfair retroactive judgment according to new standards not yet conceived of at the time. As discussed earlier, torture was illegal under English common law and recognized by many as a cruel infringement on personal integrity, and an accomplished and well-read lawyer such as More was surely cognizant of this. It was also a common charge at the time that torture was used to force false confessions from people, just as it was supposed to force true ones, a charge that Catholics later made against Elizabeth and her administration. It seems that Elizabeth and More, like Jefferson, failed their own best selves when it came to an important issue of justice and human rights, and they could and should have known better. As I look at the instruments of torture and the descriptions of how they were used, I find I have no stomach for lingering or for taking or sharing photos of the instruments or displays. It's true that these artifacts and the uses to which they are put are of historical interest. But there are photos and articles galore featuring these dreadful things in books and on the internet, and I get the feeling that this room is more often a scene of gruesome entertainment than a place of somber reflection on humankind's history of inhumanity to one another. I've no doubt that the latter very often takes place here too, but perhaps the gloomy, creepy mood of the room puts me in a pessimistic state of mind. I've seen enough representations of these instruments and read enough about them already that I feel like I'm learning nothing new, nor am I having an experience of particular value in this room. I take no photos and beat a quick retreat. We leave the chamber and head toward the southeast corner of the tower complex. On the way, we pass St. Thomas's Tower, originally built in the 1270s by Edward I, and the Traitor's Gate below it. This is where both Elizabeth and More entered the tower as prisoners. This wide arched entryway was built so that small boats could easily and securely enter the tower and deposit their detainees. Then Princess Elizabeth entered this archway by boat on March 18, 1554, as Mary's prisoner. As discussed in the previous installment of my tower visit story, Elizabeth had been connected to Sir Thomas Wyatt's rebellion, the purpose of which was to prevent Mary's marriage to King Philip of Spain and to place Elizabeth on the throne. Elizabeth was reported to have said as she entered the gate, "O Lord, I never thought to have come here as a prisoner, and I pray you all, good friends and fellows, bear me witness that I come in as no traitor, but as true woman to the Queen's Majesty as any is now living." But as our guide Simon told us earlier today, the truth of Elizabeth's protestation of total innocence is still debated to this day. When More entered Traitor's Gate as Henry VIII's prisoner on April 17, 1534, he made no such impassioned protestations of innocence. Instead, as was his wont, More made a joke. When asked for his upper garment, More offered his hat, though he would have known that what was required from him was his gown or outer coat. In addition to the warm coat he was loath to give up, More also wore his gold chain of livery en route to the tower, which appears to be a form of protest against losing his freedom and his job because he acted according to his religious beliefs. Simon told us earlier today that More's chain is still worn by the Mayor of London. The rooms in St. Thomas's Tower over the Traitor's Gate had just been rebuilt and refurbished as part of the many improvements Henry made to the tower in preparation for Anne's coronation celebrations here. Since Henry's desire to make Anne his queen was the impetus for More's imprisonment here, the irony is a bit thick. Returning to More's stated fears of suffering and death during his imprisonment, he seemed nevertheless to refuse to let them rule his decisions through sheer force of will. Prior to his entering the tower, More said to his son-in-law William Roper on his way to Lambeth Palace, where he had been summoned to take the oath of succession, "Son Roper, I thank the Lord the field is won." Aykroyd thinks More's statement admits of two interpretations: that he had conquered his feeling for his family enough to be able to leave them behind if that's what it took to stay true to his conscience, or that he had managed to conquer his fears on his own behalf so that he could better plan how to conduct himself. I'd like to think it was the latter. However, commenting as a direct observer when More made this statement, Roper believed it was the former. Roper also made an important observation about More's beliefs that landed him here in the tower. Aykroyd, like Melita Thomas of Tudor Times, points out that More, as we have seen, believed strongly in the church as a community. More believed further that its spiritual authority rests on its divinely guided consensus expressed through papal decrees. Yet both Thomas and Aykroyd point out that More's views on papal supremacy shifted somewhat over the years. Initially, as Roper, also More's earliest biographer, described it, More thought that insofar as he was also a temporal prince, the Pope's authority should not be urged so strongly by Henry VIII in his 1521 treatise, A Defense of the Seven Sacraments. Henry VIII had consulted More as an editor and advisor for the work. More's involvement was later used in the attempt to coerce and destroy him in the case that eventually led to his death. According to Roper, More was accused of, quote, "unnaturally procuring and provoking" Henry to argue strongly in favor of the Pope's authority, thereby putting, quote, "a sword into the Pope's hands to fight against himself." Yet, as we see, More remembered that affair quite differently. When it comes to spiritual rather than temporal matters, More thought of papal authority emanating from, and therefore in some sense secondary to, the church, the body of Christ on earth. But over time, More's belief in the final authority of the Pope over the earthly church strengthened to the point that he, at least in part, bet his life on it. Turning left at St. Thomas's Tower, we head for the Salt Tower at the southeast corner of the tower compound. It was built in the 1230s under King Henry III's reign. Simon told us earlier today that this is the other prime candidate as the site of More's imprisonment. It was also among the most secure chambers, so influential prisoners whose cases were most politically charged were often held here. This is, perhaps, then, the site of his daughter Margaret's visits and where More received and composed letters to her, the closest of his children. From the beginning of his imprisonment, Margaret acted as the go-between for More and his family, relaying messages and news between them. Margaret had, rather slyly, made herself welcome as a visitor to the tower by taking the oath of succession in full while adding the exculpatory clause, quote, so far as will stand the law of God. While More was required to take the full oath with no amendments or additions whatsoever, Margaret was allowed leeway in this because she was seen as covered by her husband Roper's swearing to the unalloyed oath anyway. Since she was his wife and therefore, by law and custom, his subservient, his oath applied to her as well. Since Margaret had taken the oath, it was hoped that she could influence her father to do so as well. Until More's imprisonment became more harsh and restrictive in the months preceding his death, Margaret was allowed a great deal of access to her father. Margaret was highly educated, a rarity for Tudor women, studying Latin, Greek, philosophy, theology, science, and mathematics from an early age. She wrote letters to her father in Latin to improve her skills and became an expert in that language to the extent that she translated one of Erasmus's Latin works into English for publication when she was 19. She was also a well-respected scholar, though little else of her work survives outside of her famous correspondence with her father. Among the many topics of their in-person discussions and letters, More and Margaret adapted fables he had told to her as a child to refer to the current political situation and his dispute with the king. She and More also composed a long letter in dialogue form to show clearly and compellingly why More felt he could not take the oath of succession without flouting his conscience and damning his soul. More wrote a great deal when he was imprisoned, so long as he had access to writing materials, a privilege eventually denied him as the circumstances of his imprisonment became more severe as the pressure to conform was ramped up. In addition to his correspondence, More wrote religious treatises and two of his most famous works after Utopia, The Sadness of Christ and The Dialogue of Comfort. In the latter, More retold, through one of its characters, a fable that his own mother had told him, about a priest fox who hears a wolf's and an ass's confessions. Utopia, a tale of an imaginary land with a system of philosophically derived, seemingly idealized customs and governance that are nevertheless as problematic as the idealized society in Plato's Republic, reads like a fable as well as satire. As we can see, fables played a strong role in More's imagination. Lawrence and I explored the upper and lower chambers of the Salt Tower, examining the fascinating inscriptions and drawings carved into the walls by prisoners held in these rooms over the years. We continue on and explore other parts of the tower unrelated to this story. Our last stop pertaining to this exploration takes us outside the tower walls to the Tower Hill scaffold site in Trinity Gardens, only a mile from where More had been born on Milk Street. Trinity Gardens is a pretty little park on a rise across the A100 and Tower Hill Road from the tower, dominated by the Tower Hill Memorial to those of the merchant navy and fishing fleets who died in World War II. The scaffold site, small and somewhat easy to miss, is just to the east of the memorial. A stand of palm trees that I had seen when here last in January helps me find the site again. It's surrounded by a very low concrete wall or curb interspersed with short concrete obelisk-shaped posts. Bronze green patinaed plaques contain some of the names of over 125 people, according to one of the plaques, that were put to death here over the space of around 400 years. Thomas More's, Thomas Cromwell's, and Thomas Wyatt's are among them. Three Thomases all closely connected to the histories I'm here to follow. After 1 year and 3 months of imprisonment in the Tower, after persuasion, influence, separation from his family, financial pressure, and increasingly harsh confinement failed to bend him to Henry VIII's will, More could no longer escape the executioner. More was executed on July 6, 1535, just 5 days after his trial. Henry never took kindly to opposition from anyone, but the perceived lack of loyalty from his friends and those he had shown special favor to in the past irked him most and provoked his harshest responses. Despite a long string of promises not to force his old friend More to betray his conscience, Henry ordered his execution anyway after More refused to go along with Henry's change of mind. Henry did extend one mercy to More. Instead of the protracted and agonizing traitor's death by hanging, drawing, and quartering to which he had originally been condemned, More's sentence was commuted to the relatively humane death by beheading. By all accounts, More died courageously, swearing his personal loyalty and friendship to Henry while affirming his primary loyalty to the will of God as he saw it. Characteristically, some of his last remarks were kindly and joking ones, apparently to cheer up the executioner, who More assured was simply sending him to heaven where he wanted to go anyway. More exhorted the executioner to escort him safely up the platform's wobbly steps, but to let him make his own way down afterward, and admonished him to strike carefully, since More's short neck might make him accidentally botch the job. Margaret was not there to witness More's execution. In my further research, I find that it's still uncertain as to whether this was out of grief, or because she wasn't informed in time to get there, or because she and the rest of More's family weren't allowed to attend. Despite her absence, More was no doubt comforted by the memory of his last encounter with her. Margaret waited among the crowd where she knew More would pass when he was returned to his Tower cell after his trial in Westminster Hall. Upon seeing him, she discarded the dignified bearing expected of her as a gentlewoman, pushing her way through the crowd and, recklessly, past his armed guards, and flung herself on More, showering him with embraces and kisses. According to Roper, there was scarcely a dry eye among those who witnessed this scene. Margaret was loving and solicitous of More's legacy as she had been of himself. After his severed head had been displayed for a time, Margaret conspired to have it retrieved and it was buried with her. She quickly went to work collecting, arranging, annotating, and publishing a collection of her father's works and letters. It's as much the work of Margaret as anyone else that her father's memory remained so prominent and so positive in English, Catholic, and Renaissance history. And a quick update. In researching the practice and legality of torture in Tudor England, I found more information about the inscription I found as I left the bell tower chamber where Elizabeth was imprisoned, which includes, quote, "In torture strange, my truth was tried, yet of my liberty ye denied." According to scholar Elizabeth Hanson, it was written in 1581 by Thomas Mayag, who had been imprisoned and tortured at the Tower under suspicion of involvement in an Irish rebellion against Elizabeth's reign. Special thanks to Lawrence Murphy, a patron of this Tower of London journey. Thank you once again. Ordinary Philosophy's website and podcast are independent and ad-free, and depend on support from patrons and listeners like you. To find out more about how you can contribute to Ordinary Philosophy, please visit the subscribe, submit, and support page today. And if you enjoy what you read and hear at Ordinary Philosophy, please share with those you believe will enjoy it too, and take a moment to rate and review this podcast on iTunes. And thank you, as always, for listening.